Okay, hello, welcome to LSC Ideas for our seminar today. My name is William A. Callahan. I'm a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And I'm very happy to chair this session where we will hear all about China's environmental foreign policy. We'll be discussing Dr. Heidi Wang Keating's new book. I guess it's probably backwards, but it's a nice new book, a beautiful new book. Rather than waste time telling you about it, I think we should just go straight ahead. And I'll ask Dr. Wang Keating from Keele University to talk to us for about 10, 15 minutes. Then we'll go to Professor Judith Shapiro and then Dr. Robert Faulkner to get their views on China's environmental foreign relations. So, Heidi. Oh, actually, I need to introduce you better. I call her Heidi because we're old friends. Dr. Wang Keating is a lecturer in international relations at Keele University and author of this book, which just came out this year, 2021. You're also the co-director of a film that is winning lots of awards. Can you remind me what it's called?
It's called Black Bohemia.
Black Bohemia, about kind of Hong Kong. Protests in Hong Kong. But please tell us about your book and about China's environmental foreign relations.
Thank you so much, Bill, for this introduction. Dave, may I have the presentation, please? Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It is my great honor and pleasure to be back to the LSE. And thank you so much for the invitation from the LSE Ideas, Grantham Research Institute, and also the Department of International Relations. It's very special for me to come back and share this book because I started this academic journey 9 years ago in the Department of International Relations at the LSE. So I'm really excited to share with you the key findings of this book. Next slide, please, Dave. Thank you. So this book introduces a new research agenda, which I call environmental foreign relations. I focus on relations instead of policy because I want to highlight the relational aspect of environmental cooperation. Policy, the rich literature on environmental policy, climate policy, have provided us a huge, rich insights in how China's role in global environmental governance. But I also realized the limitation in the literature because it focuses on the outcomes. And I want to give recognition to those underrepresented domestic players. And by focusing on the processes, it is also better for us to understand how the engagement of the Chinese government with the outside world on the environmental cooperation can be shaped, enabled, or disenabled by domestic forces. And one overlooked group or players, domestic players, would be interest groups. Next slide, please, Dave. So the focus on interest group actually came from my fieldwork in China. All the interviewees highlighted the importance, the political significance of interest groups. But when they communicated this idea to me, they almost kind of whispered it as it is relatively politically sensitive to talk about interest groups in China. So that's why I went back to the literature to look at how interest is defined in the Chinese cultural and political context. And you can see from this small graph, you can see that interest as defined in the Chinese context is multifaceted, and it includes both materialistic and also value related aspects. And by looking at the definition of interest, I'm reminded of the IR debate about the intersection between interests and ideas. And in the context of Chinese political landscape, interest and ideas are literally co-constitutive. Dave, can you click away the elephant cartoon so we can see the different forms of interest groups? Yes, click again. Thank you so much. Yes. And by looking at different interest groups, we can also see how they entangle domestic interest with certain concepts and ideas. I have categorized domestic players into enterprise in interest groups, institution interest groups like ministries, public interest groups like NGOs, civil society actors, and also the association interest groups like Chamber of Commerce. Next slide, please. Having defined the scope of my book, the environmental foreign relations, I need to decide the sites to observe environmental foreign relations. And these three paradigms have been highlighted in my book, and they also somehow mirror the chronological evolution of China's engagement with the rest of the world in the global environmental governance domain. Dave, click again, so you can see, yeah, for the international treaty implementation, I focus on both the enforcement led by institutional interest groups and also compliance led by association at different industrial sectors. And in terms of bilateral cooperation, I focus on how public interest groups try to help the Chinese government to share the so-called Chinese experience with other countries. And this also demonstrates the process in which the Chinese government and various players try to establish the leadership position or image among the developing countries. The last paradigm is also very recent and quite interesting, is the provision of an alternative international norm. And so that's where we observe the contestation among various domestic players. I'm looking at public association and institutional interest groups. Click again, Dave. Thank you so much. So as I mentioned earlier, interests and ideas are closely and intimately connected with each other in the Chinese political context. So that's why I also match each key concept in the different paradigms of environmental foreign relations. Next slide, please, Dave. Thank you. Okay, so here we are. There are three empirical chapters. I don't want to give you too much detail, so you're still curious enough and would consider buying this book or asking your library to buy this book. So just give you some takeaway, main takeaway from each empirical chapter. In the first empirical chapter, I compared the implementation between the Montreal Protocol and the Convention on Biological Diversity. In terms of the implementation of Montreal Protocol, I have observed a very strong enabling factor from the association interest groups, namely the refrigerator sector. They have lobbied to push the Chinese government to sign the Montreal Treaty, driven by their commercial interest. And the other takeaway from this chapter is the implementation of the Convention on Biological Diversity. The story of this implementation of this convention is also quite relevant for our discussion of China's involvement in global climate governance, because I found that the high profile national leaders' commitments to international treaties are not a guarantee for successful implementation of this international treaty. So this is a case with the biological diversity, as we can see even relatively small or weak industrial sector like the traditional Chinese medicine sector, they can mobilize a nationalistic rhetoric to undermine the political significance of environmental diplomacy. Next, please, Dave. And next, yeah, thank you so much. And the second empirical chapter is also a good example of the hidden processes of environmental cooperation. And that case also happened in the 2000s. So that's when the Chinese government encouraged companies to venture abroad. And also that's the where we observe a lot of societal energies. They are willing to share Chinese experiences in economic development, but as well as the environmental sustainable development from China. So that's why I take the protagonist of this empirical chapter is NGOs, and I try to look at how they engage, interact with more official actors like institutional and enterprise interest groups. Click, Dave, thank you. And the rhetoric for them to demonstrate their significance in environmental foreign relation, for NGOs, I mean, is the Chinese experience. They have accumulated a lot of on-the-ground information, expertise, and experience of helping local governments to enhance its environmental governance. And the NGOs also want to share this broader and also to bring a sustainable image for the Chinese state. Thank you so much. That's and so the NGOs, they wanted to help the ministries in the neighboring country, but they were rejected. This idea were rejected because the ministry did not think sustainable development belongs to the Chinese experience. But the societal energy from the NGO is still appropriated by a state-owned enterprise in a neighboring country. So this case also shows what could China have achieved had societal energy been better incorporated and integrated into the state apparatus. Next slide, please. The last chapter is about the provision of an alternative norm. So we're talking about ecological civilization. I remember very clearly when I started studying ecological civilization, I was lost in a domestic debate. And then I had a chat with Robert and he asked me, what is the audience of ecological civilization? And this is a good question because when the domestic players try to explain ecological civilization, their main audience is domestic. And they want to persuade other higher up leaders that their interests have been incorporated and integrated into this vague concept of ecological civilization. So this chapter showed how public interest groups, association, and institutional interest groups try to define ecological civilization, this political slogan, in a way which mirror their own interest. For instance, ministerial power, for the institutional interest groups. Next slide, please. Yes, so I hope this gives you a flavor of what this book is about. And the chapter, the overarching argument of my book is really to show that China's environmental foreign relations has been shaped by the negotiation process, the bargaining process between various interest groups and the regime. And specifically, they can shape the degree in which the state can commit to environmental treaties and also shape the direction and form of bilateral cooperation. And nowadays, we also observe this meaning-giving exercise by interest groups to this alternative norm of international liberal environmentalism, ecological civilization. Next slide, please. Thank you. Last but not least, I want to also mention the so what question. This is a question we were asked a lot of times during our PhD training. The study of environmental foreign relations also helps us better understand the nature of the rise of China on the global stage and could offer some insights to explain the contradictory image of Chinese behaviors and Chinese stance. So I use the phrase of constructivist utilitarian image to describe what you are observing of China's role on the global stage. On the one hand, we can see this rising normative ambition, the ecological civilization, and trying to present it as a shared future for the human being and for the future. But on the other hand, we can see this domestic interest bargaining and battle, which would influence to what extent this normative ambition can really help the global environmental governance. So all in all, we can see the crowded domestic field and also the normative ambition presented by the Chinese government. Last slide, please. So if you like my book and also this area of research, you may also like these two fascinating books, China Goes Green, and also The Environmentalism and Global International Society. And both authors are here with us. So I look forward to your comments and feedback. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Heidi, for your interesting presentation and for flagging up our two expert witnesses and commentators. First is Professor Judith Shapiro from American University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of numerous books on China and the environment, including Mao's War on Nature, which is about environmental degradation in revolutionary China, China's Environmental Challenges, which is an overview text, and the one that Heidi was just talking about, China Goes Green, together with Yifei Li, which is an exploration of the hidden costs of China's green agenda. So Professor Shapiro, you have 10 minutes.
So thank you, Heidi. Heidi and I have been circling each other for a while, I think. I think Heidi reviewed my book, I reviewed her book. And now that her book is out, I'm really happy to be part of this celebration of a book that makes a really important contribution. Particularly, I think there's a tendency to think of China as monolithic, and also a tendency to get very excited about this idea of ecological civilization without really parsing down what it might mean. So I've been given a warning here as to having only 10 minutes, but I'm going to do my best. So I thought that in the lead up to Glasgow, there's a lot of interest right now in really some of the insights of Heidi's book. We're very curious to see what China will do on carbon, and also very curious to know whether China's more concerned with its audience back home or its role on the global stage. So I'm going to rush through some of this, but I do like when I give a talk to establish my credentials here. You can see, I hope you can see that's still me, and I've been in and out of China for a really, really long time. Okay, so this latest book covers a lot of the same ground that Heidi's does. It essentially tries to understand what the hidden agendas might be when the Chinese state asserts that it's going green, right? And so my co-author Yifei Li and I identified a whole series of tools, and we found that oftentimes, yes, China is going green, but other times it's sort of pretending to go green in order to intensify its power over the individual. Yeah. So what is this? Clear waters and green mountains, or gold mountains and silver mountains, or, you know, there's a million different ways to translate this, but this is actually part of the Chinese constitution. So a lot of Western observers got very excited about this, and you know, we're seeing conferences being held in California about ecological civilization. I would say not quite so fast. Yeah, but anyway, you see these everywhere. Lucid waters and lush mountains are invaluable assets. Another example of how to translate this. Okay, so what I'm gonna focus on today is why the Chinese state might be concerned about climate change. And it's not exactly out of our book, but I think relevant for us in the lead up to Glasgow. Now, first of all, I'd like to establish that environmental issues are a threat to domestic stability and party legitimacy simply by virtue of the fact that ordinary citizens are very discontent with the level of pollution and the threats to their public health. However, they're much more aware of the health impacts of bad air, water, food, soil, and biodiversity. The threats to biodiversity. But on the other hand, the leadership gets climate change, right? The leadership is full of scientists and engineers, and they're very focused on the security impacts of rising seas, melting glaciers, extreme water events, falling aquifers, and so on. So first though, I'm gonna rush through a few slides just to give you a sense of how bad the environmental problem is. Every once in a while, the Chinese state decides to have a blue skies event. So they have Olympic blue and APEC blue and G20 blue. And this is a kind of a reminder simply of the fact that it's not so blue, right? I don't know if you can even see that that's the Forbidden City in the background. Often the focus is on Beijing, but here's an image from Gansu in the western part of the country. Lots of environmental accidents, particularly some explosions around PX plants and other kinds of chemical repositories. Here, a really tragic chemical spill, a cadmium spill. You can see the PLA in the background helping out to try to clear it up. The famous porcine coronavirus scandal in 2014, where dead pigs were dumped into the tributary of the Shanghai of China. Paris of China. famous images of little children sorting e-waste. And of course, China has now banned the import of e-waste, which is a very good thing, I think. So that's the human security risk and the discontent. And so the Chinese state knows they have to deal with that stuff, or the people are going to be very, very, very upset with the Communist Party of China, right? Then there's the national security risk that comes from climate change. So with sea level rise, there's already efforts to build sea walls outside of Shanghai, but the big cities of Shanghai, Tianjin, Guangzhou, very much threatened by sea level rise, and all of the efforts to create so-called sponge cities, where there's, you know, a lot of absorption in the infrastructure, are not enough. We saw a terrible flood about a month or two ago in the interior a bit, and that was supposed to be a sponge city, but it wasn't enough. Another issue is this question of glacier melt and falling aquifers. As you know, as the glaciers melt, in the short term, it causes floods, but then in the long term, the rivers are not replenished, and we have this situation of the North China Plain and that aquifer system dropping precipitously, so much so that I don't know if you've taken a shower in Beijing lately, but those are the lowest flow shower heads that I've ever experienced in my life. Already, you know, Beijing is very, very short of water. And so we could, from the Chinese state's point of view, be looking at a situation of climate refugees out of all of Beijing. What if Beijing simply doesn't have enough water in the long term to support life? Also, we have this question of extreme weather, floods, droughts, and storms, which we're experiencing all over the world. But this gets at a legitimacy question for the Chinese state, which goes back millennia. So for millennia, it's all been about controlling the floodwaters, right? And this is a child's cartoon, but it shows the legendary founder of the Chinese nation, Da Yu, Yu the Great. And you can see here, he's controlling the floods. So if the leaders can't control the floods, they're in big legitimacy trouble. And so certain rivers, like this is a picture of a flood of the Huang River, the Yellow River, lots of floods on the Yangtze as well. And then by contrast, also problems with drought. So what's the state doing? Okay, technocracy. For climate, there's very little role for citizens. They would say, they would teach climate change in the schools, but they say it's real. You know, there's none of this stuff that we have in America about, oh, it's, you know, Trump said, a hoax, right? It's not a hoax. There's none of that. But they're saying it's real, but the state is taking care of it. And there's little role for citizens as compared with dealing with some other environmental issues where there is a little bit of space for dealing with pollution, picking up trash, planting trees, all these apps, which give you the air pollution reading, the water pollution reading, and so on. By contrast, for climate, it's not so much. And for the people, it seems like an arm's length issue when they're facing so much immediate public health problem. So what are they doing? So they're doing stuff like they're putting these machines on the Tibetan plateau that shoot silver iodide into the atmosphere. And this binds with the monsoon rains that are coming up from India, and that makes it rain, and that may temporarily replenish the glaciers. They're also wrapping the glaciers in blankets. You know, these are things cooked up, as it were, by Beijing Normal University and Tsinghua University. Very, very technocratic. They don't see climate change so much as a human problem or a political problem or a social problem. There's lots of examples of this kind of thing. So I'm not gonna have time to talk about the citizen response, but I'll zip through some of these efforts of the people to take back their lives in a way, whether from growing their own vegetables to networking around certain sanctioned environmental causes, like the campaign to save the Tibetan antelope, which was the very first campaign back in the 90s, to taking water samples and sending the water samples to Greenpeace's headquarters and seeing what's in them, and then maybe launching a naming and shaming campaign around putting toxic chemicals into the Yangtze or elsewhere. special role for journalists, particularly this very famous Under the Dome, where people were shown to, came to understand that little children had never seen the stars. They'd never seen a blue sky. You know, this was very rallying for the Chinese people, but again, more focused on ambient air pollution than on climate change. I gotta just move through. Celebrity activism. We don't see this yet around climate change, but it could come. So anti-shark campaign, saving the elephants campaign. So almost last slide. So how is the state achieving its low carbon goals? I would argue that here again, as with some of these other green initiatives, they do tend to promote the power of the state over the individual. So for example, you have the social credit scores in China. If you recycle a lot, if you plant trees a lot, it can improve your social credit score. So similarly, if you adopt a low carbon lifestyle, it can in some way improve your social credit score and vice versa. More dams, more nuclear power, more solar, wind, and tidal, all of these things are really out of the hands of ordinary people. And if anything, these big dams are harder to resist when the state says that they need the dams in order to achieve its commitments on the global stage. Nuclear is, of course, very worrisome. It's not very safe, and there's a lot of plans to build nuclear power. Then the carbon exchanges, which are now national, the state gets to decide who gets how much carbon to trade. And so that puts a lot of power in the hands of the state over factories or governments or sporting events or whatever. It's kind of opens up room for a lot of corruption. And finally, with the promotion of green technologies, such as electric vehicles, the state will hand out the incentives and basically is going to favor the wealthy ultimately. So I think that's the end. Oh, so the question is this authoritarian environmentalism or is it instead environmental authoritarianism? I submit sometimes it's the first, but quite often it's the latter. And so thank you very much. And I am done.
Okay, bye. Thank you, Professor Shapiro. Next up is my colleague in the International Relations Department here at the LSE, Dr. Robert Faulkner, who's an associate professor and director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. His latest book is Environmentalism and Global International Society, published by Cambridge University Press this year, July. And his next book, Great Powers, Climate Change and Global Environmental Responsibilities, will be out from Oxford University Press in January 2022. So Robert, please.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks to everyone on the panel for having me as well. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for the very kind introduction, Bill. Just to clarify, I'm the research director of the Grantham Institute. We do, in fact, have a new director, Elizabeth Robinson, who joined us, and she's wonderful, and she's just taken over at Grantham. So that's what I wanted to just mention at the beginning. Heidi, many congratulations on getting the book done. It's great to see it in print. It's a very important contribution to an important debate that's clearly of global concern, and I think it's great to have this in the mix, and I look forward to your next installment in that debate. There are two things that I took away from your book which provide the sort of background to my remarks. The first is the persistent puzzle in the study of Chinese environmental diplomacy, which has been the question of just how much of the greening of China that Judy and Heidi have just talked about is actually driven by domestic concerns, and how much of it is driven by external factors. So in other words, is China promoting environmental protection because of an innate desire to fix environmental problems, or is it more in response to pressure from the international community? And this question has been raging for some time in the research community, but it also has important policy implications because it tells us something about what the West might be able to do to promote a further greening of China. And the second point that Heidi raises in her book is that given that China has criticized some aspects of the Western international order and has also increasingly sought to establish its own credentials in the environmental debate, the chapter that Heidi mentioned on ecological civilization is very instructive on this matter. This raises the question of the extent to which China's growing international role in the environmental field is also about challenging existing international approaches and institutions. So in other words, if indeed China is putting forward its own distinctive ideas about environmentalism, what would China want to put in the place of the existing global green order? How would it redesign that existing international order on the environmental plane? And again, this has huge implications for how the West can and should engage with China on global environmental issues. So I'll come back to these points towards the end of my remarks, because I think Heidi's raised some really good points on this one. Let me start perhaps by first taking this conversation more to the international level. And I'm going to run through a couple of steps that China has recently taken in the climate arena, where it has moved considerably from being a laggard to, as now some people claim, a leader in environmental policy making. And I want to use this as a springboard then for a discussion of the wider geopolitical context in which China's climate diplomacy is occurring. But just to jog everyone's memory again about how far China has come in the climate negotiations, let me take you through some of the key stages. Let's start with 2009, the Copenhagen Climate Conference, which at the time was much anticipated because it was meant to achieve a post-Kyoto treaty. And the negotiations got stuck, not least because China refused to make any moves on quantitative emission reductions, which were meant to now apply not just to the northern economies, but also to emerging markets, as was demanded by the US and also some European countries. And China at that point refused point blank to be drawn into a conversation about what it should commit to in terms of quantifiable emission reduction targets. And actually it then got blamed for the breakdown of the Copenhagen conference, something that Chinese diplomats hadn't anticipated. And it was seen as a huge loss of face and caused quite a few ripples in diplomatic circles in Beijing, something that the Chinese leadership wasn't used to, being blamed for failure to reach international consensus on a global concern. And I think that did indeed cause some soul searching. Between Copenhagen and Paris in 2015, China then moved gradually but decisively to accept some responsibility and accept a more balanced approach. And the Paris Agreement indeed includes a commitment of all major emitters, the US and China, Europe and India, to take a role in global climate mitigation. Once Donald Trump had assumed the White House in the United States, had assumed power in the US and pulled the US out of the Paris Agreement, China was then actually stepping forward as one of the main supporters, as one of the main champions of the Paris Agreement. One could argue that this was the high point of Chinese climate diplomacy, from Copenhagen in 2009, when it was blamed for the failure, to now being one of the main supporters of an agreement that at least was in the balance at the time when the US was trying to get out of the commitment it had made. And then came in September 2020, and now in September 2021, two simple but very powerful announcements that Xi Jinping made at the UN General Assembly. Last year in September, Xi announced that China would now aim for a carbon neutral goal for its own economy by 2060, 10 years behind most Western countries, but significantly early for an emerging economy. This was a big step forward because China, as I mentioned before, had so far resisted giving specific dates for such a target. And then this year, Xi went one step further and announced that China will no more build new coal power plants abroad. Again, a significant move because South Korea and Japan had recently abandoned funding for foreign coal-fired power plants, and China was the only major funder of such plants left. So this now removes most international funding for coal-fired plants. And it's also significant because China has already started first steps. The Bank of China has now announced that it would simply not enter into new financing agreements. So this is really shifting the dial on coal power, and I think these have been widely noted and praised. So what do these recent announcements signal in terms of China's commitment? First of all, China has clearly come to accept much greater responsibility for the future of global climate change. That policy shift is real. It's gone well beyond merely indicating a willingness to engage. China has made some significant steps towards putting markers down and setting targets. It's also secondly noteworthy that these policy shifts were unilateral announcements. They were relatively high profile. Both the recent announcements were delivered at the UN General Assembly. They were aimed at the international community and were clearly aimed as signals that China means business. But they also surprised domestic actors in China, but also in the international community. Many noted that these had been more ambitious than was anticipated. And what's noteworthy is that China made these announcements without asking for a kind of quid pro quo by other great powers. So China does not apparently see these as concessions in the great power game, but sees them as necessary steps to meeting global climate objectives. That's interesting, because that suggests that China is willing to play its role irrespective of what other powers, Russia, India, but also the United States are doing. And yet great power relations do matter in this. And we were reminded of this just recently in January when after President Biden had taken power in the United States and sent John Kerry, the climate representative, to Beijing, the Chinese foreign ministry repeated warnings about the worsening relations between China and the United States. And it warns that China can't take Chinese cooperation on climate change for granted. There was a veiled threat made that it would use linkage politics, including in climate politics, if this was necessary for wider geopolitical concerns. So this brings into focus this vexing question of just what the geopolitics of climate change will be as we move forward, and as we now have both the US and China much more significantly engaged in the effort to implement the Paris Agreement. And how will this play out in future years? There are some who note that clearly, the US and China are the critical two players in this, the G2 of global climate politics. They are the two largest emitters. They are the most influential players, both in the global economy and in global politics. And what they decide will determine the future fate of the planet. But what should we make of the growing geopolitical competition between China and the US? How will it play out in climate politics? There's one view which says this competition is good news for the global race to net zero, because it is indeed a race now. Both the major powers are competing for green technology, for green markets. They are trying to get ahead in that race for capturing future market spaces and investment opportunities, especially in emerging markets, and that therefore a little bit of geopolitical competition might be useful. It could be a boost for climate policy if the US saw China indeed as a future competitor around low carbon technologies and markets. But others argue, and I think there's a point to that, that geopolitical rivalry can also get in the way of that global push for net zero. It will make the two main powers more suspicious of each other. They may become more reluctant to make commitments and implement them around the net zero target. And it therefore introduces a kind of a zero-sum logic into climate politics, when in fact this should all be about collective action and working together. My argument here is that both scenarios are indeed realistic and should be taken seriously, but in fact they can coexist. They can run alongside each other. I would predict that the US-Chinese relationship on climate change will oscillate between cooperation and conflict, and that we should be prepared for both a more antagonistic and a more cooperative relationship alternating. There are opportunities here to use climate change to diffuse some of the tensions in the relationship, but at the same time, I think we should expect that this will not be a smooth run. So where does this take us then? Back to the question that I raised at the beginning about what Heidi's book contributes to this debate. The first question is, what drives China's climate leadership ambition and general trend towards greater green policies and environmental protection? Is it domestic? Is it external? As I've highlighted already, there's clearly an external dimension to this. What happened in Copenhagen in 2009 clearly stung the Chinese leadership, and China has since tried to retreat from that laggard position and has made efforts to position itself ahead of COP26 and other international efforts in a more dynamic, in a more progressive light. So there is an element, an external element to this. But at the same time, it's very clear that the announcements that Xi has made were driven by a domestic logic. There are huge concerns in China. Judy talked about this just now, around air pollution, around energy security, around the sort of general need to move ahead in the technological race for green technologies. And there's a good, therefore, domestic rationale for making these announcements. China is moving out of coal funding abroad, not just because it's good for its climate diplomatic stance, but because it's also the way the world is going. Coal is gradually being phased out in many countries, and it is coal, it is now gas to some extent, but increasingly solar and wind energy investments that will matter. And so China has clearly smelled the coffee on this and is moving ahead for good domestic reasons itself. What about the second dimension? Does China challenge Western ideas in global environmental politics? Does it have its own alternative? What does ecological civilization amount to in this regard? I remember having this conversation with Heidi many, many years ago indeed, and it still remains a very woolly and indeed nebulous concept in my view. There's not much of a difference in some of the discourses that are being had in China around ecological civilization. Similar concepts around green economy, around technology-led solutions come up. And so I struggle to see what's truly Chinese and what's very distinctive about this. In fact, I haven't as yet to detect any serious effort to displace international environmental solutions to what China has put on the table and is offering. And for that reason, I would argue there is no serious effort being made by China to displace Western approaches and ideas. There is still some ongoing contestation over how to balance developmental needs and environmental needs. But on the whole, China is in the same boat. It struggles with the same conundrums, which is to maintain growth and prosperity while dealing with these environmental challenges. Okay, let me stop here. I'm sure there will be plenty of questions that will allow us to come back to these points. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Research Director Robert. Sorry, I forgot the qualifier. Heidi, I'll give you about 10 minutes to respond to your two commentators' discussions.
Thank you. Thank you both, Judy and Robert, for your very encouraging words about my book and also for respecting my emerging little voice in this debate. Maybe I will address the two debates which highlighted by Robert, whether the environmental leadership, China's environmental leadership, is driven by domestic factor or international pressure. So why I focused on the domestic factors is also because of the existing literature has covered plenty of how international players have shaped domestic Chinese environmental governance, both in terms of institutional setup and also norm setting, as Judy has mentioned in her review of my book. So that has been very well covered. And it is evident that the very environmental infrastructure in China has benefited from the international cooperation and the amount and effort by the international players. What I want to highlight is to present a different perspective to understand the rationale or the motivations of China's emerging ambition on the global environmental governance. So that's why I focus on the domestic players and domestic interest groups specifically. I would say, of course, both would be key to move China ahead. But as you've mentioned, Xi Jinping has also made unilateral pledges on the global stage, which means regardless of the international pressure, China would move ahead with those ambitions. And he has set the target for the domestic players to follow. That means we can see also a general trend in Chinese foreign policy from 2013 onwards. We can see a more assertive foreign policy approach and trying to undermine the significance of international pressure on Chinese behavior on the global stage. So what you have mentioned about this declaration is one among those examples of undermining the political significance of international pressure in terms of China's standing on the global stage. So we would, of course, nobody knows what will happen in the future, but this is something we should look out for and to recognize the importance of domestic players in the field. And the second question is, to what extent is Chinese environmental norm challenging international institution and order? This is a great question and also a very challenging one. The reason why the Chinese government sees the need to have an alternative norm is because of its ambition to have discursive power, to have the final say in terms of how to interpret this norm, how to make sure this will not undermine the development or the national interest of China. Not too long ago, environmental protection or low carbon policy were regarded as a conspiracy for the Western country to contain the economic development of China and other developing countries. So that shows the sense of insecurity of the Chinese government in terms of dealing with a foreign concept. So the Chinese government actually knew the concept of environmental protection from the 1972 Stockholm Conference. So that's why international cooperation is important. And also the fact that this concept is foreign is also important, and also ushered in a series of localization or indigenization of environmental norm in China. As Judy has mentioned, climate risk and climate change is real in China, and people can feel the impact, and there's so many climate victims in China. But the rhetoric has been focusing on the technocratic solution, as Judy has mentioned, rather than mobilization of the societal energy or public participation, because the civil society groups have really made great contribution in promoting environmental awareness and also providing climate education to make sure it is also relatable to every ordinary citizen of China and also for business players in China. So that has to be factored in. So what I want to say is that this norm is important for the Chinese government to establish its leadership. And it's very interesting, you have mentioned what it means to have this alternative norm. Nobody knows, because there is no objectives or no action plan attached to ecological civilization. The only thing which is closer to an action plan is Xi Jinping's linkage between ecological civilization and the Belt and Road Initiative to promote this Chinese concept through infrastructure project. So that is the only thing we can link to any kind of suggestion of actions. So as Julie has mentioned, the Chinese government also tries to establish its environmental leadership on the global stage for its domestic legitimacy. So that also highlights how strong the Chinese state has been. So this foreign policy gain can also be translated into domestic legitimacy. In terms of the evidence for us to look at how China tries to revise the international order or change the way things are organized on the global environmental governance, I think one good example is to see how they try to modify existing environmental standards and protocols to make sure it is in line with Chinese expectation, Chinese way of doing things. One example would be the recent reform in the World Bank in the environmental standard. And so some countries have lobbied to lower the environmental standard with the reason that because we have alternative financiers, we have the AIIB. So that's why if you don't provide us with the funding, AIIB will. So the existence of alternative financier also make it possible to modify the existing norm or existing standard. So that's why I think it's important to keep an eye on this norm. And also by having this discursive power, the Chinese government can decide and have the final interpretation of what is included in the norm and how to phase out public participation, as Judy has highlighted and acknowledged, how to phase out public participation and how to phase out democratic decision-making, for instance, from this liberal environmentalism norm. So maybe I'll end here, and we can open the floor for questions or respond from my discussants, either way.
Thank you, Heidi. I'll respond a little. I think that, so in your chapter on ecological civilization, you talk about the idea of composite ideology, which I also use. It's a great concept, so I recommend it. And what I find useful about composite ideology is it says that ideology doesn't have to make sense, that it can be multiple and contradictory. And if you just say, aha, there's a contradiction, so it doesn't make sense, you're missing the point. Because the point is about how this is an ideology for China. So to me, I see ecological civilization, you talk about it as a composite ideology itself. I see ecological civilization as part of China's or Xi Jinping's broader composite ideology of providing a Chinese alternative. So that's why it's a Chinese alternative, not because it has any content that is necessarily a Chinese alternative, but because China says it's an alternative and China has to provide an alternative or else China's not doing its job. This is the sort of rhetoric you hear a lot of. But let's go to the floor for questions.
I wanted to add something there. Could I add something, please?
Sure.
Okay. I think this effort to create an alternative ideology and to bring ecological civilization to the fore and essentially replace ecological civilization, use ecological civilization to replace sustainable development, has to be seen in the historical context in which a lot of these institutions like the World Bank, IMF, were created at a moment, historic moment, when China was very weak and they felt that they didn't have any say in the creation of these institutions. And then as things opened up, say at the IMF, they lobbied really hard to get a Chinese person to be in at the head of the IMF, and they failed in that. So then they were like, okay, well, we're going to retake our historical status in the world that was ripped from us in the century of humiliation and the rape of a country by the Japanese and the foreign powers, and create our own institutions. And to do that, then, ecological civilization is not just something Xi Jinping made up and it's an empty concept. There are think tanks, many think tanks in China devoted to thinking through what ecological civilization means in terms of, the latest stage of the development of Marxism and, China's unique contribution to a whole other vision of the future. And one more point, and I know we do want to go to the questions, is that these official definitions about, they do have a monetary implication. So the green mountains and the blue rivers are silver mountains and gold mountains, right? So there's money involved there. So the vision is both clean and green, but also prosperous and has the sort of glittering spires of Shanghai in the background. So I'll stop there.
Sure. I mean, the notion that China has been excluded from international institutions is very popular in Beijing. But it's just not true that China was included. It was just the Republic of China. So the Communist Party was not included. China was included. I don't want to get into that debate. But let's see. The first question by Lara is, how does the interplay of actors affect investments along the Belt and Road Initiative? And to what extent does this affect global climate governance under the UNFCCC? Heidi, you need to unmute. Okay.
Do we respond one by one?
Respond one by one. I need to read through them all to get a sense of which ones are best.
Okay. So I'm not an expert in climate policy, so I can only draw some expertise from my understanding of the intersection between environmental projects and investment projects, because that's what I've covered in my second empirical chapter. In terms of overseas investment, Ministry of Commerce will approve projects, both foreign aid and foreign investment. And so, of course, they are not the only one. Ministry of Finance also play a very important part. And you're right, People's Bank of China, it's quite important in terms of setting on some regulations to make sure the financiers are in line with its expectation. So there is always ministerial struggle for power, and this is across the board in China. So I can only perhaps help you highlight who are important in this field, but because I don't have insider information from either of them, Ministry of Commerce, but not in terms of the Belt and Road Initiative. So I'm afraid I cannot give you more insights than that. So what I try to say is that ministries can also use certain rhetoric to give their action or decision more legitimacy. So this might also be the case for the climate finance. I don't know whether Judy has something to add.
Quickly. I think people think that China's government can wave their wand and that will change what their foreign direct investment and the loans are doing, but it's a very complicated playing field. And recently the Ministry of Ecology and Environment tried to put forward some guidelines for international investment, and the Ministry of Commerce shot them down. And don't forget, there's, you know, state-owned enterprises and the banks, and there's, you know, when they were building a canal across Nicaragua, they kept talking about, you know, a shadowy Chinese investor, and nobody even knew where the money was coming from. Fortunately, they didn't build that canal, right? So it's a complicated, I think this comes out a lot just in Chinese governance in general, is that the center has a lot less control over the players than one tends to think if you don't know China very well. And that applies internationally as well.
Okay, so next question. Chris asks, it's hard to read these questions. It was Paige asks, she would like to hear more about the socio-political implications of China's response to the climate crisis. A couple of, I think Heidi and Judy both talked about that this is a real concern amongst the Chinese people. And if the CCP responds poorly to the climate crisis, what would it mean for the relationship between the public and the state?
Maybe I can say a few words, and then Judy can always come and save me if I didn't cover everything. So as I mentioned earlier, climate change has been recognized by the Chinese state as political priority. But the question is, as Judy has mentioned, the solution is more technology oriented rather than education or public participation. So give you one recent example of the torrential rain in Henan, in Zhengzhou. And that incident is not really framed or understood among the general public as a climate crisis. And there is even some popular writer on the internet saying that actually global warming is good for the regime of China. So you can see the level of political the communication of climate change is not that mature, and it could be stepped up to encourage more serious engagement with climate projects on the grassroots level, on the public level. So that's one thing I want to highlight, that the absence of communication of seriousness, the severity of climate change, and the missed opportunity to educate the public when the crisis is real. Judy and Robert?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. But we have that problem, at least in America as well. When weather forecasters are covering a hurricane, they don't even talk about climate change. So there's a lot of complaints about that lack of making connections between extreme weather events, or at least the tendency towards more extreme weather events and climate change. But I think with the Henan floods, there was also some talk about how this was an opportunity for the government to start to think about how they could educate the people. I agree very much with Heidi's response.
Just a quick observation, perhaps, to add to that. It's often been observed by China analysts that the legitimacy of the Communist Party in China rests very much on its ability to deliver on the central promise, which is ever more prosperity and ever more well-being. We know all the stories of what the communist regime has achieved in terms of lifting people out of poverty and advancing the industrial strength of the country. And in that context, I think if we look forward to, say, 5-10 years from now, climate change is likely to emerge as a big threat to that legitimacy. At the moment, it may be possible to sound positive about certain aspects of global warming, but in 5 or 10 years' time, in certainly if we hit 2 to 3 degrees warming, when Shanghai is going to start disappearing under rising sea levels, it won't be possible for the Chinese government to justify its primary focus on growth, high carbon growth, in that context of a rising climate crisis. So I think the leadership is aware that it needs to begin to shift course and begin to climate proof future investments in infrastructure and industry. And I think that is as much a threat to the rule of the Chinese government as it is to democracies in the West who are built on this kind of popular legitimacy built around greater prosperity. So I just want to throw that in as an observation.
I mean, a couple of the questions have pointed to the link or the contradiction. Oh, can you still hear me? I said there's a problem with my microphone. Yes, okay. This sort of economic environment dynamic that the whole world is dealing with, as Robert was just saying, Chinese legitimacy has been mostly about economic growth and prosperity. And so I don't know whether you have anything more to say, Robert, or whether Heidi and Judy have something to say, but that's a question that has come up a bunch of times
today. Just sort of like, how can one
deal with this dynamic between economic growth and environmental sustainability?
If I may just add one dimension to it, because there's an international dimension to it as well, which is that China's response, as was outlined by both Judy and Heidi, has been very much focused on technological and economic solutions. So to grow yourself out of the climate crisis, the Chinese government has invested heavily in solar energy, wind energy, which has driven down the price of renewable energy around the world. So we've all benefited from that investment. It's invested a lot in railways, in new forms of mobility. China is trying to garner the electric vehicle market and corner that market, and is also investing heavily in geoengineering technology. So there's a very sort of a technological dimension that feeds into the narrative about continuous industrial growth. And that's certainly an important aspect to it. But I don't think it goes to the heart of the climate problem, which is that we need to change on a much broader scale, a much wider scale. It's not enough to just bring on new technologies. It's also about reducing certain forms of high carbon consumption that cannot easily be replaced with other technologies or products. And on that front, behavioral changes, shifting ideas about what it means to become more prosperous and to grow the economy, that's where the Chinese government has had very little to offer. And I don't see the concept of ecological civilization as providing any answers to that. In fact, I see many more parallels with sort of traditional liberal environmentalist ideas that we can grow and develop our way out of the climate crisis.
I'll make a quick point. As the Chinese middle class has risen and there are more billionaires in China now than anywhere in the world, inevitably people are asking themselves whether the price is too high, right? And we didn't have time for me to talk about Under the Dome, but you know, there, that documentary shows she has a fetus who has a tumor and she knows it's because of all the pollution. And they're asking themselves, is this worth it? This is not worth it, right? So, you know, we've heard about the environmental Kuznets curve, and the Chinese also like to say, well, you know, we're still a developing country. We're not quite there yet. It's too expensive, et cetera. But I think it is at a tipping point where the public is, at least in the more developed parts of the country, the public is not willing to put up with this level of pollution any longer. Food, you know, melamine in their infant formula, you know, heavy metals in your tea, dead pigs in your water, you know, it's checking the app to know whether you can go outside and play or take the bus or take your bike. You know, it's gotten to be too much. Yeah.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with this dilemma for between the environmental protection and also economic development. But if I look at the development of ecological civilization, there is a tendency for the Chinese government, at least from the official narrative, to make them coexist harmoniously and to encourage this idea of green growth and also to create this illusion that, as Judy has highlighted and explained ecological civilization, green mountain and clear water are monetized. So that's why they try to make it, compatible with each other. But that maybe is more an aspiration than a realistic reflection. And in terms of just collecting my thoughts so I think what I really want to highlight is also this behind the debate between environmental protection and economic development is the ignorance of the social and societal cost, which Judy has highlighted in her book, China Goes Green. And this has not been really discussed systematically or sufficiently in the existing literature, because the Chinese government can invest a lot in renewable energy, in clean technology, but that couldn't solve the problem. And this has been introduced in a coercive manner. So that creates actually maybe more problems rather than solutions. And to end on the coming back to ecological civilization, there is a very good article talking about what kind of future this ecological civilization is suggesting for the rest of the world. And it's very much a techno economic imagination of future, where all the solutions lie in technology, lie in maybe economic instruments, a carbon market. So instead of kind of not giving enough attention to the human rights involved in it, the vulnerable communities, the ethnic minorities. So I think that is something which we need to also factor in when we talk about this debate between economic development and environmental protection, because either could be really mechanical when we talk about social development.
Okay, one of the other questions is how important a role does youth mobilization, is that expected to play a big role in Chinese government response to climate change? Moreover, to what degree does China's climate diplomacy is expected to affect the rest of the world's response to climate change? I mean, those are big questions. You might have already answered them, but I just thought I'd throw them out there. So youth mobilization, even though it's a top-down policy and process, is there any youth mobilization? Are they an interest group, Heidi?
I don't know what age group counts as youth.
Usually below 40.
Okay, that's a very liberal definition of youth.
The Communist Youth League.
Yeah.
No.
Average age 40. That was not factually true. I remember vaguely in one of the Guardian news talking about a school girl protesting outside her school and trying to echo Greta's global activism. Of course, that didn't create a lot of echo due to the concern of local government of local political stability. So that is the main constraint for the youth mobilization. But if we look at how civil society groups try to mobilize youth and particularly give them the opportunity to go abroad and connect with other countries in a sustainable development. We can see the examples such as China House. So it is a project incubated by the Columbia University, and that has that is a organization founded in Kenya and now headquartered in Shanghai. So they try to connect university students with a local community in Kenya and also African countries to give them the opportunity to learn from and also learn and also share Chinese experience. So this is one of the rare examples I know. Maybe Judy knows more about this youth initiative.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we sit here now, we could say there's not a big youth movement about climate change, but 10 years from now, it could be very, very different situation. I know with the Chinese ENGO community, there's been more and more attention to the environmental impacts of Chinese investment overseas, more and more effort to link with indigenous groups. Sometimes some lawyers groups are actually helping, some Chinese lawyers are helping, say Peruvian indigenous groups to sue Chinese companies. So this kind of international awareness is starting to build. I do still feel, I mean, you saw the images that I shared, that the problems right in front of your face are so acute that it becomes a little bit, you know, hard to imagine that climate change is more urgent than SO2, you know, ground level pollution. There was that girl who imitated Greta Thunberg, but I think that was very much a question of imitation. The ENGOs are participating though in the different COPs. And of course, China is hosting the Convention on Biological Diversity COP in Kunming, I think in hybrid form right now, but maybe more live in the spring. And so that will allow young people to get involved because they won't have to travel internationally. So it's hard, you know, China changes all the time really fast, and it's easy to say, oh, there'll never be a youth movement. I have so many students say, I want to write about the climate movement in China. And I'm like, no, you won't, because there isn't one yet, but that could change.
Bill, let me perhaps talk about the second question that you raised, which is about whether what China does in its climate diplomacy has any effect on other countries and how important that is. I would say that is the critical question now in the COP process and in future years. If you look back in history, in the 1990s, international climate politics was all about what the United States was going to do. You know, would it join the Kyoto Protocol? In the end, it didn't. The European Union was the key driver of the international process, putting forward solutions like the European Emissions Trading System and trying to get the US to join and become a partner in that effort. And that transatlantic axis was critical, but that's no longer the case. In the US case, it's kind of oscillated between reluctance to participate and now again under Biden, some form of renewed leadership. But it's really China that's calling the shots now, because in climate politics, you are a great power and influential player if you have the largest carbon footprint. And it is China by far that has by far the largest carbon footprint. It emits the most emissions. Its future investments in infrastructure around the world will have the biggest influence on whether this infrastructure will be carbon proof or not, will be low carbon or high carbon. And so its enormous role in shaping global investment flows, financial flows, and also trade flows will be the critical factor. So what China does in a way shapes the entire climate process. And if China continues down this path that Xi has embarked on, which is to bring forward its decarbonization program, to reduce its support for high carbon infrastructure abroad, then that could entice other countries, reluctant players, think of India, think of Russia, perhaps to step up their efforts. There's also that competitive dynamic in play. If China invests ever more in renewable energy and in low carbon technologies, that will become the standard around the world. And that puts other key economic players under pressure. So I think this is the future of climate diplomacy is one for China to write. And that's the critical question of the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, there are a bunch of questions about the role of banks, whether it's the People's Bank of China or AIIB. I don't know whether the three of you feel you can answer those. But what are banks doing? I see Heidi is actually reading the questions.
I can comment quickly that I've been involved with quite a lot of projects that are seeking to pressure banks from overseas to adopt various kinds of sustainable standards. One project I was involved with is about Chinese investment in the Indonesian pulp and paper industry. There are similar efforts to get China to acknowledge indigenous rights in Peru and so on and so forth. So the banks are slow to get on board, but that is definitely the way things are going. More and more banks are adopting these different principles, and China has signed on to the UN Global Compact, which also commits to sustainability principles. The financial sector doesn't like being pressured, just like China doesn't like being pressured. It can really backfire, but I think there are some encouraging signs.
I can add a little bit about the role of the Central Bank of China in this. It's interesting to note that the Bank of England under Mark Carney was the first Western central bank to initiate a process whereby climate risk was being identified as a systemic risk to financial stability. And the Bank of England has done some good work around how to identify that risk and how to quantify it and how to include it in financial regulation and general monetary policy. But it's interesting that as this idea spread to other countries in Europe, it was the Bank of China that has come on board and has entered into a closer relationship with the Bank of England and other European central banks in defining and understanding the sort of hidden risks that climate change creates within the financial system. So in many ways, the Chinese Central Bank is one of the pioneers in that movement to get central banks to take this much more seriously. And I can only, if anyone's interested in that, I can only point you to the good work that's being done at the Grantham Research Institute on this, Simon Dekow, Nick Robbins, and of course, Nick Stern himself has been very active in China, advising regulators, the government itself, but also the central bank to take this much more seriously. So I think there is some interesting work going on. Quite how that filters down into the lending practices of banks, as Judy was saying, they're not all on board. And I think that will require a lot more of an effort there. But at least at the highest level, we seem to have seen a considerable movement in the right direction.
Okay, I have a question from an IR student in the LSE. Do you think China is poised to and willing to engage in a race for renewable energy transition? China now has a dominant role in the solar supply chain question. If so, how will China balance the interests of coal-supporting interest groups and the emerging new interest groups in favor of renewable energy?
Maybe I'll start with this question. Renewable energy has been regarded as the Chinese government as the future industry, as a strategic industry. So the race has already started, and the Chinese government has already put forward, invested particular local governments, let's say local governments, particular for the solar energy. It's very much initiated by local governments, and the competition domestically has been fierce to the extent of providing overcapacity for solar energy. What is the rest of the question?
Okay. How they're going to balance the coal interests with the new renewable energy interests.
Thank you. Thank you, Judy. So one way to look at it is to look at the transformations or the transition of state-owned enterprises, which has relied very much on fossil fuel, conventional energy resources. So that's one thing to observe. But as I said, so the wind energy has been dominated also by a mixture of state-owned enterprise and private enterprise. But for the solar energy, solar sector, it is very much private companies, and they tend to be small and medium-sized companies. So their number overwhelms the size of those solar companies. So we can see new players in the ground. And also when the local governments invested in those solar companies, they also have a vested interest to make that a success. So I would say the new interest groups would be those private companies and also those SOEs, which has the aspiration to transform into a more cleaner technology. So that's my response. It's like doing a test and see whether my examiners agree with me. But yeah, so Judy and Robert.
We all agree on this one. In fact, I would go one step further, that in some areas that technological race is already over and China has won it. When you just look at the solar sector, China has completely revolutionized how the sector works. In the beginning, in the 1990s, it was German, Danish, and some Californian firms that started to develop more effective solar panels. There was some interest in the investment community to see this as the next big thing of the renewable energy revolution. And a lot of Western money went into those companies, particularly in the United States and California. And they were all driven to the wall. They've all been eliminated in the race. The solar panel market, the global market for this, is dominated by Chinese companies. Now, you can argue this is terrible, and you know, suits have been brought against China at the WTO, at the World Trade Organization, over unfair competition and dumping. But from a climate perspective, this is terribly good news. Solar panels are so cheap now that it's cheaper to produce solar energy, even in Britain, which doesn't always benefit from the kind of continuous sunshine that our students would like to see, because of the low costs of these solar panels. So I think on a number of fronts, China has already begun to dominate this market, but there are many more innovations that are coming our way. Electric vehicles, there the competition is still very much alive, and it's not clear yet who's ahead. Yes, China is dominant in battery production, particularly because it's developed scale before many other countries have done that. But integrating these battery solutions into entire systems, cars, trucks, and so on, that's still an unresolved issue. And then there are many other technological challenges ahead. So I think that race is on, and China therefore has a good reason to push ahead with that.
Okay, thank you, Robert and Judy and Heidi. Our time has come to an end, and I would like to just give a round of applause to Heidi and her book and the wonderful discussants, and thank the audience for their excellent questions, and thank the LSE Ideas team for putting this together, Lucas and David and other people. Lucas Fiala and David Sutton in particular. So thank you, and have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.